nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
The last few lectures, we have been talking about these general equations, these NEGF equations, the non-equilibrium Green function equations, which you can use to analyze the current voltage characteristics of any device. Right? And although, as I mentioned before, at this time we are considering only what you might call elastic transport, where an electron goes from here to here without exchanging energy with the surroundings, and all the dissipation happens at the ends. And later we'll talk a little more about the generalization when you have dissipation inside as well. Okay. Now, I didn't write down those equations today, but last day I handed out this sheet which summarized all of them anyway. And if you remember, the input to all that are these two quantities, the Hamiltonian H and these self-energy functions, the sigmas. And the first step in obtaining those equations was to go from the usual Schrodinger equation, which is E psi equals H psi, to this, what looks like a modified Schrodinger equation, with two extra terms, this and this. And as I've often said, you could think of it like the isolated system was like an LC circuit with certain resonances. When you connect it to the contacts, that's the source term, that's like a voltage source, and this is like the source resistance that kind of damps the thing, right? And based on this, we obtain those NEGF equations, and as I mentioned, one of the important subtleties here is that while usually when you take a course on electromagnetic theory, like say 604, you start from Maxwell's equation and you work with the electric field, because all of that we're really usually talking about coherent sources, you know, things that are radiated by antennas, coherent signals, where electric fields superpose. Whereas here, the equivalent thing of the electric field is a wave function, but wave functions don't add. What adds is the psi star, just as you'd have with light also if you had incoherent sources. Okay? Now, so what we really need is equations that work with the psi daggers, and we define this quantity called the correlation function. That's the psi dagger. And it is related to the strength of the source, which is like SS dagger. And these are column vectors of size n by 1. So these are matrices of size n by n, just like the H and the sigma, everything else. Okay. So what I want to talk about today, though, is more about this self-energy function sigma and the source term, and give you a general feeling for how these arise, starting from Schrodinger equation. What I had done before was just to motivate this. We said, let's consider a special problem where you had a 1D wire with this 2T0 on the diagonal and minus T0 coupling to the nearest neighbors. And then we said that if you get to the contact and assume that you have an incoming wave and an out reflected wave and a transmitted wave, I showed how you'd get a self-energy term and a source term. But this was a relatively special case. In the sense, it's just a 1D wire. And so what's not clear from here is how to apply it to even just a two-dimensional conductor, you know, like you'd normally have. Normally, you might be wanting to apply it to, say, just a 2D EG in gallium arsenide, a two-dimensional electron gas in gallium arsenide where you're making measurements. Or it could be a sheet of graphene. Or it could be a three-dimensional conductor for that matter. Right? Whereas what we discussed was how to do a 1D problem. And that was just to motivate this. But as I have stated a few times, that although when you go to other problems, the details are different. But once you have the H's and sigmas, etc., rest of the equations are all much the same. Okay. So what I'll do today then is we'll try to obtain this from a more general treatment, something that doesn't assume a 1D wire for that matter. So what it does is, we'll assume that you have got some conductor here. I don't need to draw it. So let's say I've got some conductor here, H. That's this. Connected to some big reservoir that I'll call HR. So there's some big contact. And this is the actual conductor. So if I actually have to write out the matrices, this would be a small number. That's a 10 by 10, 100 by 100. This, on the other hand, if I had to write it out, would be thousands or millions by million, right? This is a big, big thing. Okay. Now, at first, let's say these two things are not connected to each other. So there's two separate things. So you could write one equation for the H part of it. You could write EI minus H psi equals 0. And a separate equation would be for the reservoir part of the story. You could write EI So this would be, if you had an isolated contact like this, actually, to be consistent, I should put an IR here, because, as you know, when I write I, what I mean here is the identity matrix. And this identity matrix is of size H, 10 by 10, 20 by 20, whatever that. This one is of size HR, of course. It's a bigger, so it's a different identity matrix. Okay. Now, with the reservoir, though, what I want to really describe is not this isolated thing sitting by itself, but something into which electrons can continually flow out and flow on in, something like. Because it is connected to a battery, and of course the essence of current flow, as I've often said, what makes this problem subtle, is that you're always connecting an external battery which maintains this at a certain fixed chemical potential. Whereas if it was an isolated system, then all that would have happened is there would be some electron exchange and then all current flow would have stopped. Reason current keeps flowing is, of course, because of the battery. It keeps taking the extra electrons out and putting them back someplace else. So to include that, what we'll do is, what people do is, they put a E plus E plus I, and I'll write a eta here. What I mean by the eta is some very small, what they call it, an infinitesimal, some very small quantity. And what that allows this electrons to do is sort of get out of this reservoir. Why is that? Well, you see, when you have something like, let's take the case where this is just a 1 by 1. So if you had, say, E minus epsilon phi equals 0, then as you know, in time, the wave function would have looked like exponential minus I epsilon t over h bar. That's what the wave function would have looked like in time. What that means is phi star phi would not be changing. That we have discussed. Now, the thing is, if you add a little E plus I eta, that effectively what it does is, here, it puts a minus I eta, t over h bar. Because now, E is equal to epsilon minus I eta, and that causes the wave function to decay with time. So, corresponding wave function would have a e to the power minus eta t over h bar. So, adding a little infinitesimal here, and the sign is very important, because if you had put a minus there, it would have grown with time. So there's always this plus I, a small infinitesimal. So sometimes instead of eta, they write 0 plus. 0 plus indicating that it's small, but the important thing is that it's small positive, not small negative. So that's how they usually write that. So that's this E plus I eta minus HR, phi R equals 0. And by introducing this, you're kind of allowing the electron sort of to go out someplace. Now, if you just solve this, then of course the solution for any given E would always be phi equals zero. There be, yes, please.
E in this H matrix, I mean the channel matrix, in source matrix, it be the same. I mean, we have used same E for both.
Right. Same E because we are talking of an open system where we'll eventually be talking of electrons with a certain energy going in there. Okay? So it is not like these are the resonances of this particular thing. So the one point I had made before is that, you see, when you have something like this, then the argument usually is that unless E is exactly equal to epsilon, you do not have any solutions. So the only allowed solutions are E equals epsilon. Well, and in that case, of course, the energy eigenvalues of this and this could be totally different. So this could have a level at 2 millivolts. This could have a level at, say, 0.2 millivolts. So there's no good reason why the energies should match when you view it that way. But what we are viewing it as is this open system way. What that means is that this E is not necessarily equal to that. This E is simply whatever energy the source, the excitation source has. So it is like an analogy I've often used is, if you use LC circuit or a guitar, much the same thing, but LC circuit has a resonance of 100 megahertz. But you could always hit it at 99 megahertz and see what response you get. Right? If it matched the resonance frequency, it would give you a big response, that's all. Same with a guitar. It has a resonance, but you can always hit it with a tuning fork that's a little bit off. So same here. So this is kind of the frequency at which you hit it, whereas this is its resonance. So similarly, in this equation, that's the resonance. That the eigenvalues of this give you the resonance. This is just the energy with which you're hitting it, at which the electrons are coming in. And those don't have to be equal. Although the way I've written this, you'd think that the only solution to this is phi equals zero. Because it's like we took the LC circuit, added a resistance, but we haven't yet added a source term. And so basically any oscillations will just die out. So sooner or later, this equation would just describe a system where sooner or later all the electrons just flow out. Just leave and go away. But you also need to have something to put it back.
So this I eta is the same as the sigma term.
Right. This I eta is an infinitesimal, and this sigma, however, need not be an infinitesimal. It can be 1 millivolt, 10 millivolt, some sizable number. And what I'll do is start from here, and then with some algebra, we'll get to this eventually. Okay? So in the literature, they usually put in this infinitesimal without really explaining physically what it means. And they kind of act like, well, you know, it's just a small thing, doesn't really matter too much. But the thing is, it's really a very profound change from saying E minus H phi equals zero to put in this and then put in a little source term here. It's really a very profound change. Yeah.
Generally, when people talk about resonances, they introduce a quality factor. Could this be introduced here?
Right. Quality factor, again, simply is like the, you know, the LC and R, right? So R, LC gives you a very sharp resonance. The R broadens it out a little bit. And quality factor is how much it is broadened relative to the zero frequency. So here I'd say, yeah, the more the coupling to the contacts. So what happens usually is something like this, that if you had an isolated device, it would have given you energy levels like this. And by coupling it to the contact, each one sort of broadens out like that. And if you broaden it sufficiently, then it looks like one continuous thing. Right? And once it looks like one continuous thing, that's when it starts behaving more like a normal conductor in a way. Right? So, for example, like with transistors, as you know, these days, transistors, the length of the active region is like 1,000 angstroms, or less, 500 angstroms. That's 50 nanometers, that's what, 200 atoms or so. But 20, 30 years ago, these lengths were like 5 microns, 10 microns. And people always say that, well, you know, once transistors get below 1 micron, you should start seeing all kinds of quantum effects. Why? Because, you know, after all, when something is 1 micron wide, you could show the energy levels of a box that's 1 micron long would look like this. It would be discrete. You would have these discrete levels separated by something that's a few millivolts, let's say. So you should start seeing quantum effects. And of course, people make the transistor smaller than that. No one saw anything really. And now it's down to 500 atoms, and still there's no great evidence of any quantum effects really in that sense. Right? And the reason is that, sure, you have levels like that, but by the time you connect it to contact and they all broaden out, it more or less looks like this. Because in a transistor, of course, you are always trying to make good contacts. Good contacts that make it easy for electrons to flow in and out. And so it ends up looking like this. And so the fact that it's 50 atoms long or 500 atoms long doesn't seem to matter too much, finally. And that you could say is a kind of the quality factor in a way, that because each resonance has been broadened more or less by the amount of the spacing, that's why it looks that way. On the other hand, if you actually deliberately made a device with bad contacts, then you'd start seeing all kinds of effects due to the quantized levels. Okay, so getting back to this then, the point I was trying to make is that you have a reservoir for which we use a normal kind of Schrodinger equation, but with two modifications, namely this little infinitesimal, which tells you electrons can leak out from there, and something that keeps replenishing it. Right? And the assumption is the source term is strong enough, is just right, to maintain the right electron density inside your contact, you know, which corresponds to its chemical potential, the right thing. And then you have the device region for which I'm just using a normal Schrodinger equation. And at this time, these two things are just separate, no connections. And next thing what we'll do is we'll add a connection there. And the connection goes like this, that you have E minus H psi, but we now have something that takes points from inside H and connects it to points inside HR out here. So there are things that connect you that way. So what you could do is add a connection here. Let me, maybe it would be best if I write this in a matrix form. So let's write it like this. So we had these two isolated things, and I wrote two separate equations here. And I've now just written it in a matrix form like this. So this is the matrix. This is the device part of the matrix, or channel part. This is the contact part. This contact has something connected there to keep it, etc. And now what I want to do is add something here, this minus tau, which is like the part of the Hamiltonian that couples the channel into the contact. And these things are Hermitian, so you'll have a minus tau dagger here. So this is the coupling that we are putting in. Now, once you put in the coupling, of course, what will happen is in the reservoir, what you had before will change a little bit. It won't stay at phi r. You'll change it to, so let me, so this new part that is generated as a result, I'll put a chi here. This is the, so originally you had something there, and now you have connected it to the contact, and so it changes by a certain amount, and that change I put as this chi. And so this is now the equation of the coupled system. And after this, what I'm going to do, so all the physics is right here. This is it. So after this, what I'm trying to do is get to this equation. And the way I'll do it is I'll somehow eliminate the reservoir part of the problem. So another way of saying what we have here is that as if we wrote one big Schrodinger equation for the channel plus the contact. The channel was, let's say, 10 by 10. The contact is, let's say, 1 million by 1 million. And we have written one big Schrodinger equation for the whole thing. And the only distinction between the channel and the contact is in the contact, we are putting in a little coupling to the outside. So electrons go in and out of it. And that is, that's it. Yeah, psi is like, to start with, there was nothing there anyway. So whatever I'm putting there, you could view as the change. Right? So this thing, it had no sources or anything left. So left to itself, there was no electrons in there. And now when we connect it to the contacts, things will come in. Right? That's it. Whereas this one, left to itself, already had electrons in it. It's all filled. Okay, so that's it. So let's look at the second equation. And this is written in matrix form, but let me write it out. So you'd have something like this. This times phi r plus this times chi, and then tau dagger times psi. And all that is equal to sr. That's it. So I just basically wrote out that second line, multiplied it all out. And now I can cancel this with that. Why? Because, that's how we have defined this in the first place. That this was what you had when the reservoir was sitting by itself. So that's all out. So that I can cancel, and so I'm left with this. So what I can do next is, I can write this chi in terms of the psi. So can you help me with what should be here? Note, I canceled this. So this minus this is equal to 0. So what that means is this is equal to this. So I could have just dropped everything else and just written it in a clean way. So it would be this is equal to this. So if I just want this one, what do we do? Well, it's the inverse of this times tau dagger psi. That's it. So finally, it will be chi is equal to inverse of this, which I'll call gr. That's like the Green's function of the reservoir by itself, of the isolated reservoir by itself, gr tau dagger psi. That's it. Okay, so okay, where GR is defined as, it is the Green function of the isolated reservoir. Next, what I'll do is I'll go to that top equation, the first equation. Let's write that out. So you have EI minus H acting on psi minus tau times phi r. Minus tau times chi. Good to see. So what I did was, I just wrote out that first equation, EI minus H times psi minus tau times phi r minus tau times chi. That's equal to zero. That's it. Or I could take this over to the other side and just write it this way. Now, I already have this quantity, the chi, in terms of the psi. So I can replace it, and then I'll basically have what we are looking for, the final equation. That is, instead of this, let's put in gr tau dagger psi. So I can replace this guy. So this term then also becomes something times psi. That's it. So the final form you'd have then is, write it here. So from here, and can you give me the, what's the expression for sigma and what's the expression for S? Can you help me?
Sigma is
tau dagger. Right? So it's tau gr tau dagger. That's it. And the source term is just this, tau phi r. So that's the end result. So let me write those things here. So we'll have it. So what we did then, and if you look back, took the Schrodinger equation for the entire coupled system and then tried to eliminate the reservoir part of the problem. Eliminate the reservoir, and what you then get is an equation for just your channel, just the device part of it, and you have the sigma psi, that this extra term here, and the source term. Like I said, a resistance and this source voltage type of thing. And the sigma, the general expression for sigma then is this one, tau gr tau dagger. What is GR? It's the Green's function of this isolated contact. So if you have a very complicated contact, the issue then is how to find that. Okay? And the source term is tau times phi R. So, yeah. And this eta here was supposed to be an infinitesimal, like I said before. But then this sigma is not an infinitesimal. Once you calculate, it can be a sizable thing, yeah.
But won't in this case sigma depends upon HR. So dimensionally, this matrix can be a lot bigger than H.
Very good point. So, you know, the real advantage from a practical point of view is that this was 10 by 10, this is a million by million. And once I go to this equation, everything is just 10 by 10. I don't have to mess with this million by million anymore. That's the real practical advantage, right? And the way you see that from here is, you see, this GR, it's the isolated contact. So the size of this is a million by million. But the size of the tau, what does the tau do? It connects a million points in general of the reservoir to 10 points of your channel. So the tau itself is like a 10 by million. And that one is like a million by 10. And once I've multiplied it all out, it's 10 by 10. Okay? So for any contact, you have to evaluate this. That's the first part of your job. But once you have it, after that, it's just a 10 by 10 matrix. You don't worry about all this anymore. It's all done. Okay? That's the thing. And so this is the sigma. Now, corresponding to this, you could write the gamma, if you like. As you know, gamma is like I sigma minus sigma dagger. That's like taking the imaginary part of the sigma. So here it would be like I, you know, sigma minus sigma dagger. And what happens is you get, you can show this, that this would be like taking I tau GR minus GR dagger times tau dagger. And I times GR minus GR dagger is the spectral function of the contact itself. So you end up with this. So if you wanted this gamma, as I've mentioned before, the sigma has a real part and an imaginary part. And the imaginary part represents how easily electrons come in and out. That really depends on this tau dagger and A of the reservoir. So that's like the density of states of the reservoir. So how easily electrons get in and out depends on how strongly it is coupled to the reservoir times the density of states in the reservoir at that energy. And this is a more general version of something you may have seen elsewhere, like what's called the Fermi's golden rule. That is, the rate of coupling out depends on this matrix element square times density of states. If you haven't seen it yet, don't worry about it. Just mention that. Now, what I want to talk about next is, then, how would you actually evaluate this G? Because it seems like the biggest problem then is, okay, we have a general expression here, but then this is a million by million. How exactly do we go about getting it? Okay. So that's what I'll talk about after this, right after this. Okay. Now, let me just mention one other thing here, and that is that you remember this gamma we had talked about, and then I had mentioned that the source term, the strength of the source term we saw in that special case, was actually related to the gamma. So here, now we have an expression for the source term. And as you know, the sigma n is like SS dagger. And SS dagger, as you can see, would be like tau phi r dagger, tau dagger. So that would be like the source strength of the source term. And in general, the point is the strength of the source term is actually like gamma times the Fermi function, right? This has, we had seen in the context of a 1D problem, but this is really more generally true. How do you see that? Well, you see it's got tau dagger. Now gamma is tau times this density of states or spectral function times tau dagger. And the thing is here, this basically represents the electron density in the contact, phi dagger, you see. And that, of course, is equal to density of states times the Fermi function in the contact, you see? So what happens is you could view this as AR times whatever the Fermi function is in there. And so the strength of the source term becomes like the gamma times F in general. Okay? That's it. Okay. Okay, so this then is the general way to obtain this expression for the self-energy function, sigma. And what I'll talk about next is how you actually evaluate it. Okay. So The problem we had done before, like a 1D problem, there you had lattice points like this with a diagonal element that was 2t0 and a connection to the next one, which is minus t0. Now, in general, so let's take a problem where, let's say it's not just one point like this, but you got like a 2D conductor, lots of them. And with connections this way also, right? So in general, when you write it down, you'd have some diagonal term and then connection to nearest neighbors, and it'd be a H matrix would look something like that. Now, conceptually, you could still visualize it as if, you know, I could take these three things, three or, you know, could be 10, 20, whatever it is, and write it as, say, some alpha. That's these three things, let's say. These three things as another alpha. And then there's a coupling between this and this, which I could call, say, beta. So when you have a, in a 1D conductor, this was relatively simple. You had 2T0 and the coupling was minus T0. These were all numbers. But what I'm trying to say is that even in a more general conductor, you could always conceptually think of it as this 3x3 element, which itself is like a 3x3 matrix then. So if I'm writing the Hamiltonian for this whole thing, I could have written it like alpha, 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 and then beta, beta dagger, beta, beta dagger, etc. So I could have written, visualized the Hamiltonian as looking something like this, where, you know, if it was just one line, then this would be 2T0, and that would be minus T0. But now, this is a 3x3 matrix, that is a 3x3 matrix, that is a 3x3 matrix, etc. But that's a very powerful way of thinking about bigger things. You know, this could be a graphene with some complicated interconnections, but at the end of the day, if your current flow is in a certain direction, it's convenient to think of it as, you know, one unit coupled to the next unit, coupled to the next unit, coupled to the next unit. And each unit could be 10 by 10, could be 20 by 20, conceptually could be fairly big, right? Okay. Now, so let us say this is what your contact looks like. And then you have this device here. And from your device, there's a tau that connects you, tau that connects back. And what we really want is, you know, what we're trying to evaluate is this sigma. It's tau, GR, tau dagger. So what I need is this Green's function of that isolated contact of this thing. Okay? Now, first point I want to make is that if you had a thing like this running off to infinity on that direction, you know, very far in that direction, so let's say there are 3 points here, and let's say we have 1 million of these, one after the other. So it's got three. So the entire thing is like 3 million points. So how big would the GR be? That's this isolate, the Green's function of the isolated contact. What would be the size of the matrix? It will be 3 million by 3 million. You know, because you got 3 million points there. But do I really need all of them? Not exactly, because, you see, what I really need is this tau GR tau dagger. And the tau is this connection to the device itself. And the thing is that any point on the device, when it is connected to the contact, it's really connected only to one of these 3 points. There's no direct connection over there. So when I look at this tau matrix, it looks like on the device side, whatever it is, but on this side, the only non-zero elements are these first three. See? So the point I'm trying to make is that you really do not need this full GR. All you need is what you call the surface Green's function. All you need is that if you take this and invert it, what will this first 3x3 be? That's the thing. That if I'm trying to find this GR, in general, it looks like, you know, EIR minus HR inverse E plus I eta. So this is what I'm really trying to find. And this HR itself, of course, looks like this big thing. Like this. Goes on and on. And as I said, this could be 3 by 3, but then there's a million of them there, so the entire matrix is huge. But after I've inverted it, I'll get this huge matrix, but all I care about is this top 3 by 3. That's all I really need. And that's what you call the surface Green's function. So all I need is these 3 points. Why? Because the tau from the device only connects to those 3. There's no direct connection anywhere else, really. So what I need really is not the full capital G of that entire big reservoir, but just the surface Green's function of that reservoir. Small. Okay. So the question then is, how do I find this top 3 by 3 here? Of course, that itself isn't a very simple problem because you see the matrix is huge. So it's not like I can take this much and invert it and say, well, I got this part. Not really. I mean, it's the inverse of this whole complicated thing. It's got connections all over. So straightforwardly, you'd think I'd have to invert this whole thing in order to get that part right. You see, this is the, I have to take the EI minus this, invert the whole thing, and that's how I'll get that. Okay? And this is where there's a very simple recursive method that works very nicely numerically and often analytically also. You can get nice answers from it. And that's what I want to describe to you quickly. So the way the argument goes is something like this. What we want to do is find the surface Green's function of something looking like this. Now, let us say there was no connection to the surroundings at all. So it is just no connection to the rest of the lead at all. I just had this much. Then what would be the surface Green's function? I mean, it would be just that one column. And so you'd write G, I'll call it G1, indicating that all I have is one of these, nothing more. So then it would just be E plus I eta times I minus alpha inverse. And I'd be done. Why? Because, you know, it's just this thing not connected to anything else. So it's just this alpha. So no problem. Now let's say I want to do for two of them. So I've got one row like this, another row like this, and this connection. And I want to know what is the surface Green's function of this. So now it's a 6 by 6. If I inverted it, I'd get the 6 by 6 matrix. But all I care about is the top 3 by 3. I'm trying to write this surface Green's function. So now what I claim is, the way I could do this is, I could view this as my main thing and treat this one as a self-energy on this. That is, because as you know, in general, there is this expression for the self-energy, which is this tau, G tau dagger. So I know the G for just one column like this. That's G1. And so this self-energy that I should use for this would be tau G1 tau dagger. And if I invert that, so I have EI minus alpha, and then there's the extra sigma that comes in, tau G1 tau dagger. And if I invert that, I should get what I could call G2. So this is now the surface Green's function, but for a lead with two columns. So let's see if we get this right. So if you had one column, that's it. That's straightforward. If you have two columns, then what we are saying is work with one column and treat the second column as a self-energy on it, the sigma, and then you invert that, and then you'll get G2. That is the argument. Yes.
Say this again.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I shouldn't have written tau. In this case, because this connection is what we call beta, I should have written beta. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, great. The tau was what I had used for the general thing. For this problem, we are thinking of it as columns of alpha connected by beta. And this is, by the way, a general technique for matrix inversion. Almost has nothing to do with quantum mechanics or anything. This is one of the things you can show easily, that if you have a matrix looking like this, A, B, C, D, and you want to invert it, and you are only interested in this part of the matrix after inversion, the point is, here, what you get, you can show easily with a little matrix algebra, is A minus B D inverse C. Inverse. So if you have a general matrix like this, where A, B, C, D themselves are matrices, and after inverting it, you're only interested in this, with a little algebra, you can show that that element will be A minus B D inverse C inverse. And that's exact. And you could call this like the self-energy in a way. So here also we did the same thing. It's sort of like, okay, I've got this entire 6 by 6 to worry about. But then I only want the top 3 by 3. So this is like the BD. This is the A and that's the BD inverse C. This is like the that second column inverted gave you G1. Okay. Now, the point is that you can continue this further. That is, in general, if you want to write the G for a section with N plus 1, what you should do is start with this and then use G with N. So that's the bottom line. This is what I'm really trying to show. So the idea is, you look at one column, treat the remaining n sections that follow it, and this is the self-energy due to connecting to that entire n section after that. That's the self-energy. So this is your A. That's your BD inverse C sort of thing. And then this whole thing inverted then gives you G for n plus 1. And the way you start off is by starting with G1, that's the easy one. Then you do it again, you'll get G2. Do it again, you'll get G3, G4. So that way, you can basically build up the surface Green's function of something that goes on to infinity. And at the end of it, when you kind of quit, when Gn plus 1 becomes the same as Gn, essentially. At that point, you say, okay, this looks like what it should be for the infinite thing. Okay? So this is this recursive method that's very widely used for, you know, evaluating, for getting the G for any arbitrary contact. Because any contact you can always represent as diagonal elements alphas connected to the next one by these betas. And the special case that we did before, that's where the alpha was 2t0 and the beta was minus t0. In which case, these were just numbers. And what we had, and in that case, if you remember, we actually got this self-energy as minus t0 e to the power ika, which you could view as t0 square times minus 1 over t0 e to the power ika. So this would be like the tau and the tau dagger. That's the t0 square. And this is like the G. So what you could do is, from this expression, if you apply it to the special case of this 1D wire, then the alpha is 2t0, the beta is minus t0, and the thing is, because these are numbers, what happens is this just becomes a quadratic equation. You see, in general, the problem is it's a matrix quadratic equation. That's a hard one. That is much harder to solve. But if you go to one by one elements, this is just a quadratic equation. And you can easily solve it. So that's like, I think, one of the homework problems. I think that's due next week. Basically, what it tells you is, you know, start from this, use T0s and true T0, obtain an expression, and show that you get back what you had before. That's basically the purpose of that homework problem, right? And the other homework problem is one where you have a rectangular conductor, and you actually use this recursive method. I ask you to use this recursive method to find the sigma to use. Okay. So we're out of time today. Let me stop here, and next day I'll try to summarize the whole thing properly.